From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Jonah Lehrer says creativity is like a magic trick. The result is amazing and hard to figure out, but there's something very real going on to make it work. In his new book, Lehrer explores how. He writes about the brain's network of neurotransmitters and electrical cells. He writes about the importance of relaxation and stimulation and collaboration. The imagination, he says, is not a single thing. It's a talent that takes on multiple forms, and it isn't just given to certain people. It's an impulse that's hardwired into all of our brains, and Lehrer says we can all learn to use it. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about the science of creativity, but also the techniques that bring it about, like daydreaming and being critical and thinking like a kid. The book is called Imagine. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science writer Jonah Lehrer is joining us to talk about how creativity works. He's written a book that dispels the idea that we often hold about creativity, that only certain people get it. Lehrer says imagination is not a fixed feature of the mind. It's a variety of different processes. So he explores the brain's network of neurotransmitters, but he also gets at culture and collaboration. Lehrer says this doesn't mean we've unlocked the secret to imagination, but understanding it better, he says, will give us a better sense of who we are. It's an impulse that's hardwired into all of our brains, and so he says we can learn to use it, to harness it. His book is called Imagine, How Creativity Works, and Jonah Lehrer is joining us, as we said. We invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Jonah Lehrer is a contributing editor at Wired, a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. He also regularly appears on WNYC's Radio Lab. His other books are Proust Was a Neuroscientist and How We Decide. And John is joining us today from the studios of member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Jonah Lehrer, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I guess I wanted to start by asking you, what is it that, I mean, you've thought about this a lot, I guess, but what first got you thinking about this particular idea of just trying to figure out just how creativity works?
It was really the mystery. I was drawn to the mystery, in particular the mystery behind moments of insight, those epiphanies that come in the shower or while we're on a walk or while we're playing ping pong.
Right.
These breakthroughs that happen when we least expect them. And what's so interesting about moments of insight is you can't explain how they happen. You have no idea why the idea came to you just then. And so that struck me as a very, very mysterious mental phenomenon that I wanted to know more about.
You say in the book that really until the Enlightenment, we humans thought of imagination as this higher power, which we figured, you know, because it was so mysterious, couldn't have really come from us. It had to come from somewhere else.
Yeah, we blamed our creativity on the gods. We outsourced the imagination to the muses. This was something that seemed so mysterious, we couldn't possibly imagine that it came from inside our own head, that the idea of inventing ideas out of thin air just seemed so wondrous, we assumed it was, in a sense, a superpower. Mm. And so that's why we never really took it seriously as a human talent and never really tried to develop and nurture it.
So it seems like if it's so ephemeral and fleeting, I guess this is why scientists have been reluctant to trace it and figure it out.
For a long time, the mystery of creativity was so mysterious it also intimidated scientists. Yeah. There was a meta-review done a few years ago that found between 1950 and 2000, less than 1% of all psychology papers looked at aspects of creativity. So this wasn't a big scientific subject, in part because we had no idea how to measure it. You know, it's very easy to understand how one might measure or quantify aspects of perception and sensation, vision, let's say. But how does one measure new ideas? How does one measure the imagination? It just seemed very, very mysterious, especially when it comes to, of course, moments of insight, because how does one study epiphanies? You can't just put undergraduates in a brain scanner and say, okay, have an epiphany, we're ready for you. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So scientists had to get very, very clever and creative in their own ways to even study creativity.
Well, it's interesting how a lot of our behaviors we can make sense of through evolution and biology, but imagination, it's harder to track down in that way.
Yeah, there are no clear precursors. And there is something fundamentally different, of course, about human ingenuity. I mean, we live in world, You know, we live in worlds surrounded by our own inventions. You can look around and everything around you, this world of culture and things and gadgets and clothes and shows on the radio, is all a testament to human creativity. So there does seem to be something rather unique. There are clearly, you know, this clearly didn't really literally come out of the blue.
Yeah.
It, you know, clearly was layered on top of previous biological inventions. But there is something rather unique about human creativity. And it was that uniqueness that I think was so intimidating for scientists.
So how do you define it? I mean, you say the standard definition kind of gets it wrong.
Well, you know, creativity in itself is rather easy to define. It's just the making of something new that's useful.
Yeah.
But I think we have gotten the, you know, our theories of creativity a little bit wrong for a long, long time. And that's that for a long time we've assumed that creativity is a singular thing. It's a single type of thought process. So if you're trying to invent something new, there's one way you should always be thinking. And then it's an all or nothing phenomenon. So you either have it, in which case you're a lucky creative type who takes dictation from the gods, or you're like the rest of us and you're basically reduced to repeating the work of others for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Both of those ideas about creativity are totally wrong. Creativity, turns out, is a catch-all term for a variety of distinct thought processes, each of which is well-suited to different kinds of creative problems. And it's also a universal human talent. It's something we are all capable of, something we all do all the time. It is embedded in our most basic operating code. We are all creative. It doesn't mean we're all equally creative. It's a talent on a bell curve like any other human talent. But the fact that it's universal means we can all get better at it.
One thing you notice in the book, there's this kind of running theme about, I sense from you wanting the book to be more than just, you know, the scientific exploration or this, you know, rumination on creativity, but you really want the book to be useful.
Absolutely. I mean, what interests me as a writer is not just the science, but finding ways to connect the science to the real world, to everyday life. A lot of the experiments one is forced to do in the lab can seem a little bit abstract, you know, having undergrads do silly things in brain scanners. And so, you know, what really interests me is how those experiments relate to Yo-Yo Ma's creativity, or Bob Dylan writing Like a Rolling Stone, or the Pixar offices, to these examples of real world creativity. And I think it also teaches us something interesting about the science. I think one thing that the latest drafts of science make clear is that even though these ideas are new in terms of exactly which brain areas light up when we do certain aspects of creativity, a lot of these ideas have been intuited by creative people for a long, long time, in many instances for thousands of years. And so the science can help clarify these intuitions, show us which intuitions are true and which ones are actually mistaken. But a lot of these ideas are things that creative people have been relying on for a while. And so they're not exactly brand new. And
right.
So I also wanted to put these new scientific ideas in a larger context and explore the fact that creative people have been using them already. They've already been put to the test, so to speak.
I guess the brain science, that makes sense that it would, you know, and as you work through that. But I wonder, were you surprised by the level to which culture and collaboration plays a part in creativity?
I was. I mean, in large part, I think because we've got one of, you know, the other longstanding myths of creativity is that it's a singular thing, that it's one person all by themselves who shifts the paradigm and changes the way we think about everything, that Steve Jobs all by himself invents the iPhone and the iPad and all the rest. And when you look at stories of creativity and innovation, you often find that they're incredibly collaborative, that Jobs once said creativity is just connecting things. Well, most of those connections come from other people. They come from the other people we live around, you know, we share a city with, we share a culture with, that we are always borrowing ideas, stealing ideas, and then finding new ways to mash them together. One of my favorite studies in the book is a study by the sociologist Martin Reff, who's now at Princeton, and he tracked 766 graduates of Stanford Business School who had gone on to become entrepreneurs. And I think, especially when it comes to entrepreneurs, we tend to valorize the individual, people like Richard Branson and Steve Jobs and the guys at Google and Mark Zuckerberg, guys who we assume they are solely responsible for their success. But what Martin Reff found is that entrepreneurs with diverse social networks, so people who spend time with lots of other people who are not at all like them, who had full, you know, lots of surprising friendships, that they were three times more innovative than those with predictable social networks. And he measured innovation in terms of the number of patents they'd invented, how much money they made from those patents, and so on. So this is a very clear demonstration that one very reliable way to predict how creative we'll be is to simply look at our friendships. Are we hanging out with lots of people who think different thoughts, who speak different languages, who attack problems from different perspectives? If so, we're going to be a lot more creative.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the Bob Dylan story. I know you've told it again and again, I'm sure, but I want to get into the deeper elements of the book. But the story is important. So just talk about this, if you would. It begins with Bob Dylan being really bored, or anyway, sick of his music.
Yeah, no, I should confess I'm a Bob Dylan fanatic. So I'm a big, big fan. I've seen him far too many times live in concert. But this is one of my favorite Bob Dylan stories.
Yeah.
And it takes place in May 1965 when he's just finished his tour of the UK. And he's burnt out, basically. He is bored with his music. When you watch the live shows from the time, he seems to be in a hurry to get off stage. He doesn't make eye contact with the audience. He sings in a monotone. He is not performing at his best. So he actually tells his manager after his last shows in London that he is quitting the music business, that he is done with the singing and songwriting. He's going to move to a rural cabin in Woodstock, New York, and he's just going to become a painter. And so that's it. He wasn't bluffing. He rides his motorcycle straight out of New York City upon returning and spends a couple days in Woodstock. After a couple days in Woodstock, he gets this familiar feeling, the itch of unwritten words, he calls it. And so what does he do? He does the only thing he knows how to do, which is he gets out a pencil and a piece of paper and he starts to scribble. And his hand doesn't stop moving for the next several hours. He ends up writing more than 25 pages of what he called vomit, you know, the words just coming out of him, this uncontrollable rush of associations. And a lot of the words he never sees again. But within those 25 pages, he finds the lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone, in particular, the now immortal chorus, How Does It Feel to be on Your Own, Like a Complete Unknown, Like a Rolling Stone. And as soon as he writes those down, he knows this is it, that he has written his best song, that he has found a way to reinvent himself. The very next week, he brings those lyrics into the cramped space of Studio A, Columbia Records in New York City, and on just the fourth take, they record Like a Rolling Stone. So I love that story in particular because it captures something interesting about moments of insight, which is what happened to Bob Dylan when he was visited by the ghost, as he put it, and just started scribbling down these lyrics, is that moments of insight often come when we least expect it, and they also often come after we've hit the wall, after we've basically given up because the problem seems impossible. And then we take a break, then we go on vacation, then we go to Woodstock because we've quit singing songwriting, and that's when, of course, we write our best song.
Yeah. So what had happened? I guess what happened with Bob Dylan was that the insight was, as you say, when he had sort of put it aside for a while, which we'll talk about. That's an important element here. But also, he found a thread that had connected all these different things that were going on in his mind.
I think, you know, the larger frustration of Dylan at that point was he was singing, he was sick of being a folk singer. He was sick of being trapped and people expecting him to sing these political songs, just strumming his guitar by himself. He wanted to break out of that. But he didn't know how to bring together his disparate list of influences to bear on his new music. He didn't know how to combine Woody Guthrie and Robert Johnson, Blake and Brecht and Fellini, how to combine all these things he loved into his music. And I think what happened in Woodstock is that for the first time he was able to mix these influences together. He was able to write a song that reflected the full diversity of his loves, of his musical loves. And that's where Like a Rolling Stone came from.
So his brain, I guess it works like this, and you write about the right hemisphere of the brain. I mean, this is the part of the brain that sort of gets at meaning, not literal definitions, but, you know, the more abstract metaphors. And the neuroscientist Mark Beeman, you write about, talking about this moment of insight is when those connections happen. It's like a needle, finding a needle in a haystack. It's really amazing if you think of the odds.
Absolutely. And for a long time, there has been this pop cliche about, you know, the right hemisphere is the artist inside the head and the left hemisphere is the accountant. It's all analytical and rational. And that's for sure a vast oversimplification. But one thing neuroscientists have found in recent years is that our hemispheres do have different tendencies, that the right hemisphere is more interested in the forest, is more interested in seeing the whole, the gestalt, seeing the connections, the connotations between things, whereas the left hemisphere is more granular, more detail-oriented. It's better at noticing the trees. Now, when you need a moment of insight, when you want to be like Bob Dylan, bring together all these things that seem to have nothing in common, what does Bertolt Brecht have in common with Woody Guthrie? You're probably going to need to rely on your right hemisphere, which is better at finding those connections. And so what people like Mark Beeman and John Cuneo, neuroscientists at Northwestern and Drexel, respectively, what they've done has come up with a way to generate lots of moments of insight in the lab so they can see what's happening inside your brain when you have one of these like a Rolling Stone moments. And what they've discovered is that in the seconds before people have a moment of insight, a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus in the back of the right hemisphere just behind your ear shows a sharp spike in activity. It lights up. And this is a brain area nobody knows too much about. It's still pretty obscure, but it's been previously associated with things like the processing of jokes. It seems to get active when you hear a punchline, and also the interpretation of metaphors. And this begins to make a little bit sense. You know, when you hear a joke or when you're trying to make sense of a metaphor, when, you know, Romeo's saying that Juliet is like the sun, you can't make sense of that metaphor by looking at what they have in common, because Juliet and suns have literally nothing in common. Instead, you make sense of metaphors by looking for their remote associations, looking past these surface dissimilarities, and instead finding their underlying connections. And the same thing is true when you need to solve a very, very difficult problem. You probably can make sense of that problem by looking for the obvious connections, because if they were obvious, you probably would have solved it already. Instead, the moment of insight is going to depend on you finding their remote associations. And that's what this one brain area in the back of your right hemisphere seems to be especially good at.
So is our brain, you also write later in the book about creativity is not necessarily, at least as I understand it, the brain doesn't perceive it as entirely efficient. So is our brain trying to force us into something new, or does it prefer that we do rote tasks? Do you know what I mean? Preserve energy. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, in a sense, we really are designed to think in literal prose, not symbolist poetry. And, you know, and so that's why moments of insight tend to be few and far between. That's why if you're focused on the task, if you're focused on the problem, you probably are not going to have a moment of insight, that it's very easy to ignore that quiet voice coming from the back of your head trying to give you the answer. In fact, I think we spend a lot of time, we waste too much time ignoring that voice simply because we assume that the way to be productive is to always focus, to be efficient. But when you need a moment of insight, I think you have to follow the advice of Einstein, who said, creativity is the residue of wasted time. You'll only be able to hear that voice, and Beeman and Kunius have also found this, when you're more relaxed, when you take a break, when you leave the computer and the office and the cubicle far behind, when you go away to Woodstock, so to speak, that's when, you know, you'll be shampooing your hair in the shower, and at long last you'll turn the spotlight of attention inwards because you're relaxed and your mind wandering, and that's when you hear the quiet voice. Maybe that voice has been there for hours or days or weeks, you just haven't taken a moment to listen. So I mean, you're absolutely right to point out that our brain, especially in this day and age in which we live, we're always trying to be efficient. We're always trying to focus, because that's how we assume we're most productive. But when it comes to moments of insight, that's often exactly backwards. You want to be inefficient. You want to do stuff that's going to look to your boss like you're wasting your time.
Right. Jonah Lehrer is with us. His book is called Imagine How Creativity Works. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the science writer Jonah Lehrer explores how creativity works, the brain's network of neurotransmitters and electrical cells and dopamine responses. But he also writes about the importance of relaxation and stimulation and collaboration. The book is called Imagine How Creativity Works. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So you begin one section of the book with this story about how masking tape was conceived, which sort of leads to this conversation about alpha waves, and I wanted to talk about that. But let's start with the story. This is 1925, and it involves this kind of incredible guy named Dick Drew.
Yes, and he's a sandpaper salesman.
Yeah,
that's what he does. He spends most of his time going to Audi body shops and selling them sandpaper. You know, after someone gets in an accident, you sand down the bruised area of the car, and then you apply a fresh coat of paint. And what he noticed is that these auto repair shops, they have this problem where they cover the car with these vast rolls of butcher paper, and they have to apply this very sticky adhesive to the car. And then they paint around the butcher paper so they can apply the paint in very straight lines. But what often happens, this was very, very frustrating to these guys in the auto repair shops, is that when they go to remove the butcher paper, the adhesive they're using is so strong, this very sticky tack, that it often rips off the paint they just applied, and sometimes even the paint that had been on there for a while. So it's clear that the adhesive is way too strong, and it's just the most frustrating thing for these guys. Their labor is constantly being undone. So Dick Drew watches this happen again and again, and then he has a minor epiphany, which is that he can begin to solve this problem. Even though he's just a sandpaper salesman, he realizes that sandpaper in many respects is well suited to the job if you simply left out the sand. That really what he's selling is paper plus adhesive and a sand. So if you simply left out the gritty sand, you could have a product which may help these guys solve their butcher paper problem, solve their painting problem. So he spends a long, long time working on this. His boss discourages him, tells Dick, you know, you're a salesman. What are you doing? You're not a scientist. Just sell me some sandpaper. But Dick Drew refuses to give up. And after a long time tinkering, trying to get the adhesive just the right level of stickiness, he comes up with this amazing product called masking tape. And it's a product we, of course, take for granted now. We assume tape has been around forever, and yet it hasn't been around forever. Someone had to dream it up, and it was dreamt up by the sandpaper salesman who found a way to let these auto body shop people apply their butcher paper, mark it without having to tear off the paint, without having to ruin the cars in the process. He then went on to create an even more famous invention, which is now known as Scotch tape.
Yeah.
And this happened when he simply saw this new DuPont product called cellophane. Then he had this crazy idea that wouldn't it be fun if you simply put adhesive on cellophane and also put it in this roll of tape format? And so that's where Scotch tape came from. And so within a few years after he invented these two kinds of tape, 3M, which had just been a sandpaper company, became, in essence, a consumer products company. It started dominating the office supply business.
Well, maybe it's the name or its association with office supplies, but our outward impression, mine anyway, of 3M was this, kind of buttoned down American corporation. But you write about the culture of creativity at that company, and it's one of the most innovative there is.
You know, what interests me about 3M is that it's not sexy. It's not on the short list of innovative companies that everyone's talking about. It's not Google or Apple or Facebook or all these companies in Silicon Valley. And that's in large part a testament to its success, that we just take it for granted that 3M has been pioneering innovative products for 70 plus years. And it's not just about Scotch tape and, masking tape or even Post-it notes. That 3M has 50,000 employees and about 50,000 products, giving it a one-to-one employee-to-product ratio. That it's also making the glue that holds together your smartphones. It's helped solve the battery life problem for laptops. It's a huge player in drug delivery and medical supplies. So it is everywhere. And so I really wanted to understand, here's a time-tested innovative culture. Here's a corporate culture which has worked for a long, long time. 3M is no flash in the pan. And I really wanted to understand how it happened. What allowed 3M to be such a successful and creative company for a long time?
So you discovered some of the techniques that they use to become innovative, sort of the tricks about creativity. And I wanted to start with one of the first features, what they call their flexible attention policy, where employees are allowed to not goof off, but work on new ideas, different things.
Yeah, they give every researcher 15% of their workday to work on side projects, to work on hobbies, to pursue ideas that they're just interested in. The only requirement is that they share these ideas with their colleagues at various science fairs that are held throughout 3M. So that's it. And sometimes these side projects become great ideas. ScotchGuard actually began as a side project. So sometimes they become very, very lucrative new product lines. But I think the most important message of the 15% rule, which actually, ironically, most people now associate with Google because Google copied the 3M model.
Yeah.
Is that it sends this message of attentional freedom. It's really a message to their researchers saying, look, we hired you. We think you're smart. We don't want to micromanage your day. You know, if you want to take a nap on the couch because you're stuck on a problem, go take a nap. You want to play some ping pong, go play some ping pong. You want to go for a long hike in the middle of the corporate campus, go for a walk. You know, find a way to relax, or, you know, sit at your desk and work on your computer. Just they don't want to micromanage their employees. They want to let their employees manage their own workday. And I think that's paid dividends again and again at 3M.
Mm. So what this, of course, brings us to what you call the science of insight. So explain why interrupting our focus. Why is that? What's going on? What's helpful there?
Well, I think we do have this assumption that when you're stuck with a really hard problem, what we all need to do is to, you know, chug a triple espresso, drink some Red Bull, to find some way to increase our focus, to make it easier to concentrate on the problem itself. You know, this plugs into our larger notions about what productivity looks like.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if your boss is walking past, you don't want to be playing Angry Birds or taking a nap. You want to be, you know, you want to look focused. You want to look like you're actually doing something on your computer screen in your cubicle. But when it comes to moments of insight, like I said before, that approach is often exactly backwards. Mm. That what Beeman and Kunios and colleagues at the University College of London have found is that it's possible to predict up to 8 seconds in advance whether or not someone is likely to have a moment of insight. So I just think for a second how spooky this is. They can look at your brainwaves, and they are using this. They're using a technology called EEG, which is wearing, it's like wearing a big bulky shower cap on your head that measures all these waves of electricity pouring out of your cortex. And just by looking at your EEG waves, they can predict far in advance whether or not you're going to be able to have a moment of insight. So they can look at your EEG and they can say, you know, sorry, buddy, you can try all day, but it's just not going to happen for you. You should just go home and save us all a lot of frustration. Or they can say in about 7.5 seconds, chances are pretty good you're going to have a breakthrough. So brace yourself. The predictive signal they're looking for, the predictive brainwave, is something called alpha waves. Mm. Like most things in the mind, it remains pretty mysterious. But alpha waves are closely associated with states of relaxation. So things that lead to lots of alpha wave activity are things like going for a walk in nature, taking a nap on your couch, watching TV with a beer, taking a hot shower, doing whatever it is you do that puts your mind at ease, that makes you stop thinking about work. Now, the reason these states of relaxation are so important is that when we're not relaxed, when we're focused, when we're trying to look productive, when we've just chugged, you know, 5 Cokes and we're just staring straight ahead at our computer screen, that's where our attention is. We're very vigilant, and so we're obsessed with the problem, and we're probably stuck on a wrong answer. And it's not until we're relaxed, until we're shampooing our hair in the shower, that we're able to turn the spotlight of attention inwards and actually hear that quiet voice coming from the anterior superior temporal gyrus that's trying to give us the answer. So we can begin to understand why states of relaxation, why going for that walk, why taking a shower, why playing ping pong is actually an important ingredient in solving our hardest problems, that the answer will only arrive after you stop searching for it.
Mm. So I guess the idea is that you want your brain to be open to, as you put it in the book, this wide range of possibilities. And there's this experiment that you write about. It explored the problem-solving abilities of patients who had these severe attention problems, which you would think wouldn't have these insights, but it's kind of remarkable, the findings.
Yeah, so this is a variety of problem. It's a typical moment of insight problem. It's, you know, one of these brain teasers that's solved in one of these aha moments where people's eyes go all wide. And they give these problems to, you know, people like you or me, people without serious brain damage, and they give it to people with very, very severe brain damage. So these are people who, you know, often can't lead normal lives because they're basically unable to pay attention for long stretches of time, sometimes for more than 10 seconds at a time. Their attention is always flitting about. And what they found is that when you give people these problems that require moments of insight, that those who can't pay attention because of a serious brain injury, often a big lesion to their frontal lobes, that they are sometimes twice as effective as normal people, as people like you or me, at solving these very, very difficult creative problems. And in a sense, that's because not being able to pay attention, not being able to focus on the problem, to get trapped in these routines of thinking, is actually a creative blessing and makes it easier to come up with the radical new solution, to look at the problem from a very unconventional perspective.
So there are these moments of insight that you write about, but imagination also involves this focused creativity. And in the book, you explore kind of another misconception or myth about creativity, that it comes as this this act of radical genius, that, you know, that the long slog of perseverance seems really dull and not very imaginative, but it's a really critical part of the creative process.
I mean, I certainly wish I could tell you that, you know, science says the way to solve every creative problem is to take a hot shower,
yeah,
or go for a walk or go on vacation. I mean, that'd be wonderful news. And certainly relaxation plays a very important part in the creative process. But when you talk to creative people, at first they typically begin by telling you their romantic story of the breakthrough, that epiphany in the shower. But then they often, if you press them, they talk about all the hard work that came after. That even after they had their epiphany, they still had to go through lots and lots of edits and revisions. They had to refine the idea until it was perfect. And you can see this in the journals and letters of creative geniuses, too. So you can look at the journals of Beethoven, who, you know, the canonical example of creative genius. And Beethoven talks about how hard he's working all the time, how he typically goes through 70 different versions of a single musical phrase. So even Beethoven, one of the most talented composers of all time, still had to put in a tremendous amount of work. And this is an essential part of the creative process too. So, you know, you often have to put in lots of work and then you hit the wall and then you need an insight. So then you should take a vacation, but then you may have the insight and you got to put in the work again, make that insight perfect. So the creative process in the real world is often, you know, this varied cycle where we have these highs full of breakthroughs and moments of insight. And then we've got these lows where it's, we just got to slog through. We've got to rely on those muscles of grit. We've got to be stubborn and persistent and simply refuse to quit. That is just as important as the big breakthrough.
You write about the experience of W.H. Auden, the poet, who liked to sort of pound Benzedrine and would go on these, you know, really amazing outpourings of creativity when he did that. And it kind of transformed his writing style and gave him a kind of clarity. Now, it wasn't healthy. It wasn't good for him. You make that point. But I guess the point wasn't that he used drugs, but that the drugs helped him to persevere.
Yeah. One thing that's always fascinated me about the career of W.H. Auden, and I'm a big fan of his poetry, is that when you look at his most anthologized poems, the poems he's most famous for, they all come during this 3 or 4 year window of his career. And this is when he first moved to New York City. And so I'd always assumed it was really just because he'd moved to New York City and was in a new environment. And so he was inspired to write a new kind of poetry. And I think that played a part in it. But I think it also helped that shortly after he moved to New York City, he started popping Benzedrine. It's an amphetamine. And he started taking these pills simply so he could go to the clubs at night. He'd work during the day and then stay up all night. So that's why he started with the pills. But then he soon discovered that these pills also allowed him to focus during the day, that if he took one of these pills in the morning, he could spend 12 hours focusing on a single line of poetry or a single metaphor or sometimes even just one adjective for a long, long time. He could persist with his poetry until it was perfect, until it was lucid and spare and crystalline. And so he, you know, even though he was known before for writing some ambiguous and obscure lyrics, his poetry during his Benzedrine phase is much simpler, much more precise, and I think that helps explain why it's so popular. I happen to really like his late poetry, too, because it's a little bit more relaxed and loose and carefree and intimate. But certainly the poems he's most famous for occur during his Benzedrine phase. Now, as you point out, one would never want to recommend Benzedrine as a creative tool simply because it comes with horrible side effects. It is very addictive. Insomnia, heart problems, constipation. Auden would spend many years trying to quit later on. But I do think it's interesting to look at how this drug, which turned Auden, as he put it, into a poetry machine, how it changed his poetry itself, how it changed the kind of poetry he was able to create simply because he was able to focus on these details of his words for a long, long stretch of time.
So here we've got two different stories going on. You've got Bob Dylan's free form, you know, in Like a Rolling Stone. You have Auden's really precise rhymes. And you write about sort of the difference between the two. And you talk about Nietzsche, who said that there were these two archetypes of creativity. You've got the Dionysian drive and then the spirit of Apollo. They both get to a moment of creativity, but they're kind of different.
Yes. And you know, it's not that Auden never had insights.
Sure.
And that Dylan never put in the work. I think, you know, when you look at these stories of creative people, they all rely on both phases. So I think what Nietzsche's distinction really captures is that people have different tendencies, that some people tend to rely more heavily on their moments of insight and tend to take them more seriously and are more interested in leaving them intact, sometimes leaving their mess intact as well. You know, like a Rolling Stone, no one would argue it's this incredibly precise story. In fact, one of its charms and one of its real, you know, one of the things that gives it so much power and made it so influential was that it feels messy. It feels, in a sense, rough and imprecise and full of ambiguous lines. So it's that I think creative people have different tendencies. Some are more likely to rely on this Dionysian drive where they take their moments of insight seriously. And some are more like Auden and the spirit of Apollo, where they're more interested in crafting very precise, orderly lyrics and lines. So I think there are these two archetypes of creativity. And this is an interesting way where I think you see the science echoing ideas that have been around for a while, you know, really since the ancient Greeks. That's where Nietzsche got his distinction from. So it's always nice to see the science come up with convergent answers to begin to explain the anatomy, so to speak, of these old ideas.
Before we head to a break, I wanted to have you to tell the story of watching Yo-Yo Ma work through a sort of sight read a piece and sort of work his way into it. It gets at a big lesson here, and I want you to talk about that too. But we talk about that experience.
It was a pretty wonderful experience. I've been a huge fan of Yo-Yo's work for a long, long time, and I've always been enthralled as someone who doesn't know very much about classical music. At you can still listen to a Yo-Yo performance, and you find yourself feeling these feelings that you can't explain where they come from. It's just he's such an emotional and expressive performer. And so I wanted to understand how, in the midst of playing these very, very complicated and extended pieces, how he finds a way to stay loose, to stay expressive on stage. And so he was kind enough to let me watch some rehearsals and to even let, you know, spend some time with him backstage. And then after I watched him rehearse and watched him backstage, and he stayed so relaxed and stayed so loose backstage, I got to ask him a few questions. And I asked him, you know, how do you keep yourself from getting so nervous? And he told me this wonderful story. I mean, he said, first of all, everyone gets nervous. That's just the business. If you're not nervous, you probably don't care enough. So he says he is a little nervous. But then he says, before he walks out on stage, he often thinks about Julia Child. And my first reaction was, Julia Child? Why are you thinking about a French chef before you walk out on stage? And he describes the experience of watching her on television, where she'd make this beautiful roast chicken and she'd take it out of the oven. And she's talking to the camera, and then right then in front of the audience, she drops the chicken on the floor. And he said, you know, he always thought it was so wonderful how she reacted to that, because did she look in horror? Did she scream out loud? Nope, she didn't even break into a sweat, just picked the chicken up off the floor, brushed off the dust, and then went on, never broke a smile. I mean, the smile never left her face. And he says he always thinks about that because he knows he's going to make a mistake when he's out there. He's going to misplay a note, he's going to rush a phrase, but he welcomes that first mistake because after you make that first mistake, then you are free. Then you can focus on what matters, which is simply expressing those feelings that need to be expressed.
He talks about how people should aspire to the state of the beginner, which is, I guess, this idea of channeling that inner seven-year-old. You know, you explore and you do things just for the sheer pleasure of it.
Absolutely, where you're not worried about drawing outside the lines. You're not worried about making every possible mistake. You are doing it because you're just enthralled with the act of performing, because you love this music and you want to convey, you want to express what's held inside.
Jonah Lehrer is with us. His latest book is called Imagine How Creativity Works. We'll get to some of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with science writer Jonah Lehrer. We're talking about his book, Imagine How Creativity Works. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from John, who's in Salt Lake. John, welcome.
Hi. I had heard that Thomas Edison, when he was trying to solve problems, would sit in a chair and hold a bowling ball. And he thought that that place right before sleep is where all the answers came from, and I just wondered if you had heard about that.
Jonah Lehrer?
It's a wonderful anecdote, and you're probably happy to hear that there's good research to back up Thomas Edison's theory.
That's good to know, because it makes you wonder.
That those moments when we're most groggy, when we're half asleep, lying in bed at 6 in the morning, and we're really trying to fall back asleep, that those really are the moments when we have some of our best ideas. This is a study that actually came out last month, so it's a brand new study. What they did was they asked a bunch of undergraduates if they are morning people or night people. And of course, most undergraduates said they were night people. Then they brought them back first thing in the morning in the lab before they had a cup of coffee, and they gave them a bunch of creative puzzles, very difficult creative puzzles. And what they found is that when these kids were at their groggiest, so night people working in the morning and morning people working late at night, they solved far more puzzles. So this suggests that there really is something magical about being a little bit sleepy, being in that netherworld between being fully awake and being in a deep sleep, that we're better able to access our unconscious. The right hemisphere seems to be a little bit more active. And maybe that's why we're more creative. But we definitely should not overlook that space, that liminal space between sleep and wakefulness.
Is it time of day? There's an email from Connor who wants to know, how does time of day play into all of this? He says, I come up with most of my best ideas as I'm going to sleep at night.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting about time of day is it's tough to come up with a universal prescription. So yeah. What this study found is that if you're a morning person, you're going to be most creative at night. And this is, I think, paradoxical. This is going to be surprising for a lot of people, because I think we do associate our productivity with when we're most awake and alert. So if you're a morning person, try to tackle that difficult creative problem before you fall asleep, right before you fall asleep. And if you're a night person, first thing when you wake up is think about this hard creative problem. The research suggests you'll be more effective at solving it.
Thanks very much, John. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Martin is with us in Draper. Martin, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm very delighted to be listening to this program and your guest. I heard something about Bob Dylan that really resonated with me when you mentioned that he finally needed to take a break from his pace and go off to Woodstock. I thought, you know, I had a similar experience. I had been a heavy commercial industrial contractor for 40 years. And over that time frame, running very large, time-sensitive jobs, we were always up against a unique problem in digging in the underground and not being able to tell where the underground utility infrastructure was. So this was very troubling to me because we did an amazing amount of damage unintended.
Martin, I'm gonna step in for a moment, push it towards a conclusion. I'm guessing you had a moment of insight, right?
Yeah, and the point I wanted to make was I kept thinking, how could we solve this? You know, what would we need that if we had would make a difference? And the way the answer came to me that ultimately allowed me to invent a technology that's serving a big solution to the problem was, after the job shut down and the crews went home, I would get in the trench and I would just sit there and just relax, and I'd sit on a pipe, and I would imagine, just in a very relaxed state, things that might be helpful that made a lot of sense to me personally, and I played with the idea in a very relaxed state. And ultimately,
Jonah Lehrer, does that resonate for you? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean it's not quite Woodstock, but if a pipe in a trench works for you,
yeah.
Amen. No. I think the caller raised an important point, which is that I think so many people feel so rushed, so busy throughout the day, that we don't make time to let ourselves have those moments of relaxation, even if it's in a trench at the end of a long, long day. Mm. And I think that's part of the reason why so many people now have these stories about having their best ideas in the shower. Because when you think about it, what is the one place we can't take our smartphones? The one place we can't check email or Twitter or Facebook? We can't always feel busy and rushed. But we just let ourselves get bored and relaxed and let our minds start to wander. And that's in the shower. And I do think forcing ourselves to build in these moments of relaxation is an important thing. We have to learn to daydream productively. It's not an accident that people who daydream more score higher on tests of creativity. This is a very important mental state. It's really important to let yourself get relaxed, get a little bit bored, and then let your mind take you to somewhere interesting.
Martin, sorry to push you along there, but thanks. 801-585-WEST is the number to call. I want to ask you about a collaboration, because you write about this. You talk about how, you know, when it works, it feels like magic. But you talk about the reason that it works. And it's important to say that group activity is important, but the kind of group activity that gets us to creativity is really important. Talk about Brian Uzzi's work, if you would, who studied Broadway musicals.
Yeah. He spent a number of years trying to figure out what's the ideal way to assemble a creative team. And his template was Broadway musicals, simply because Broadway musicals are this structure of collaboration. No one creates a musical by themselves. You need a lyricist, a librettist, a choreographer. You need a director who are taking notes from producers. So it really is a team effort. So then what's the ideal way to structure that team?
Yeah.
He went in assuming that the best musicals were produced by teams where everyone knew each other, where they had a high level of social intimacy. So maybe they'd worked together before, maybe they were all friends. But that's not what he found. He found that musicals that were produced when people knew each other too well, they tended to fail at the box office. Mm-hmm. And they also weren't liked by the critics, because the critics said, this is more of the same old, we've already seen this before. So then Uzzi looked at musicals produced when people were all strangers, when they didn't know each other at all, they never worked together before. And he found that these musicals also didn't succeed at the box office, and they also were panned by the critics because they didn't kind of hold together. Instead, Uzzi discovered there was this very small sweet spot of collaboration, that the ideal structure seemed to be having a few people who knew each other well, but then having a couple fresh voices too, people who mixed it up. So when you assemble a team, it's important to seek out those fresh voices. Uzi's favorite example of a musical produced at this ideal level of collaboration, this sweet spot of team assignment, is West Side Story. Mm. There were three people who had worked together a number of times, Arthur Lorentz, Jerome Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, but they realized they needed a new lyricist, someone who was a fresh voice, someone who had never worked on Broadway before. Their producers thought they were crazy because this guy had no experience. They ended up finding this 25-year-old, like I said, never worked on Broadway, but his name was Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah.
So when in doubt, when you assemble your next creative team, be sure to include a Stephen Sondheim character. Be sure to include a fresh voice who people have never worked with before, because they'll mix it up. They will keep everyone engaged and thinking in new, fresh, innovative ways.
So be comfortable with each other, just not too comfortable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You want some tension in the room. You want people to be a little bit uncomfortable.
Well, that idea of the tension in the room and constructive criticism, those kinds of things, leads us to Pixar. And you tell the story of the Pixar Animation Studio and how they came to be really so successful on a consistent basis. And you talk about the evolution of this process, you know, really kind of evolved over like 30 years.
Yeah.
But talk about, you went to the headquarters there to kind of understand that level of collaboration. And what you found, I guess it started with the design of the building itself. Mm-hmm. The physical building itself was really critical, that interaction.
Yeah, and this was a design really pioneered by Steve Jobs. He took a very active role in designing the Pixar headquarters. People at Pixar sometimes refer to the building as Steve's movie. This is in the late 1990s. And the original plan for the studio called for three separate buildings. So you'd have the computer scientists in one building, the animators in a second building, and the writers, directors, editors, producers, and so on in the third building. Steve thought this was a terrible idea. He insisted that everyone in the studio be in the exact same building. They share a space. Simply because he realized that the success of Pixar would depend on getting these different cultures to work together, getting the computer scientists to learn from the animators and vice versa. But then he realized, you know what, it's not enough to just put people in the same building. You have to make them mix and mingle.
Yeah.
So he carved out this big atrium and he started putting everything important in the atrium. He put the gift store there and the mailboxes and the coffee shop and the cafeteria. But he realized, you know what, even that's not enough, because you can build people a gleaming cafeteria, but the computer scientists will just have lunch with the computer scientists,
right,
and so on. So then in his stroke of genius, he decided there'd be only two bathrooms in the entire Pixar studios, and he put those in the atrium. Simply because if there's one place we all have to go every day, it's the bathroom. And so even though at first people at Pixar thought this was so annoying, such a waste of time having to walk 5 minutes to the bathroom every time you needed to pee, now you hear again and again these stories of these bathroom epiphanies, these people who have these great insights and conversations while washing their hands in the bathroom sink, or while on their way to the bathroom, they strike up a random chat in the hallway, that the design of the building really forces people to collaborate and mix and mingle. It encourages human friction, and it really is the human friction that makes the sparks.
And constructive criticism you write about, it's one of the things that you get at Pixar, this idea of debate and criticism. And people, I guess, they're not looking for what's right. They're looking for what's wrong.
Yeah, and you know, and that is an important part of Pixar's process. They're big believers in iteration. They believe that if you spend 4.5, maybe 5 years trying to find all your failures, trying to find those little mistakes in the footage and the story that don't work, eventually you'll come up with a pretty good 90-minute cartoon. Mm. And I think this is best summarized in a really interesting quote by Lee Unkrich, who's the director of Toy Story 3, who I was trying to ask him, you know, what's the secret sauce of Pixar? What makes it able to pump out such consistently good and successful movies? And he says, you know, most places assume the way to succeed is to avoid failure. Mm. But at Pixar, they know that, you know, doing something new, doing something creative, is inevitably going to involve failures and screw-ups. That's why the goal at Pixar is to simply screw up as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
They want to fail fast, and then they want to fix it together. And then the question becomes, well, how do you find those failures? How do you identify them before it's too late? And that's where constructive criticism and debate and dissent become so essential. You can't find your failures unless you're willing to encourage people to point them out.
We didn't get to everything I was hoping to. I mean, we had a call earlier about wanting to know the influence of cities and neighborhoods to creativity, and you have a whole chapter that sort of deals with this idea of the village being vital. You know, how cities take on personalities, and you also write about how Shakespeare was shaped by his culture, and you say this is why culture matters. Say something about that, if you would.
Sure. What interests me about Shakespeare is this larger question of what sociologists refer to as ages of excess genius. These are these sudden flourishings of talent where you get all these geniuses living in basically the same zip code at the same time.
Yeah.
So you get ancient Athens, you get Renaissance Florence, you get Elizabethan England, where you don't just have William Shakespeare. You have William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe and John Donne and Francis Bacon. You go down the list, and it's an intimidating list of geniuses living in London in the 1580s and 1590s. And for a long time, historians have brushed aside these ages of excess geniuses, kind of historical flukes. It's just accidents of history. But I argue that there really are these patterns, these themes that recur again and again in all these ages of excess genius. So it's stuff like, you know, the expansion of educational opportunity. Shakespeare's father was a glover, signed his name with a mark, probably illiterate. Mm. And yet Shakespeare was being given lessons in Latin at the age of 8. Christopher Marlowe was given a full scholarship to Cambridge University. So the pool of human capital is expanded. You see new ways of sharing information. Shakespeare got a benefit from the birth of the publishing industry. So themes and patterns like that, what I think is most directly relevant to the 21st century, especially 21st century America, is how we can apply those same lessons to our problems right now. And Bill James, who's the pioneer of sabermetrics in baseball, the brains behind Moneyball, he makes this very interesting comparison that America is great at pumping out athletic talent, that we live in an age of excess genius for athletes. So we have to apply those same rules that allow us to generate athletic talent to everyone else, to writing geniuses and engineering geniuses and painting geniuses, that it's within our reach. We just have to, you know, apply those same lessons.
Jonah Lehrer, his book is called Imagine How Creativity Works. Jonah, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.